with author Samuel Blumenfeld of Boston, author, critic, and astute observer of the American educational scene. Mr. Blumenfeld, I've read your books with great interest, but I'm especially interested in the title of the book now in progress, Is Public Education Necessary? Could we perhaps begin our interview by asking you the meaning of your of this title?
Is to bring finally the question to the American people about public education, whether it is viable, whether it is necessary. And my view at this point is that it not only is not necessary, but that it's a positive danger for us as a people, that public education has gone far astray and it has now become the instrument for the totalitarians in our society to create whatever they want using
I suppose you're referring to the elitist idea that we can make of our children anything we wish, particularly the behaviorists who are receiving maybe 99% of the government funds. And
yes, the behaviorists, as a matter of fact, are getting an awful lot of federal money. HEW has been pumping a lot of money into new curricula.
Because I consider HEW a bureaucratic monster gone berserk. I don't know how you feel about HEW, but...
Well, I would agree with you. I would agree with you on that. As a matter of fact, I'm a firm opponent of bureaucracy in general because I believe that bureaucracy is totalitarian in its drift. It seems to just accumulate more power and more power, and because they are basically non-productive, they have to keep inventing schemes by way of which
more paperwork
they can get, by way of which they can get more money from the public, and they always have to justify it, because the public eventually wises up to what the bureaucracy is doing.
Well, I've always heard the expression that any bureaucracy feeds on itself until the point of total collapse, or...
Yes, but need we go through this collapse, you see? That
No.
is, I believe that as an intelligent nation, we can see the trend of events, we can see the drift of things, and that we can reverse them if we want to.
You say we can reverse them, but how can we affect, how can we change? You know, legislation has been going the other way. I'm speaking of some of the child advocacy legislation, and how can the average person affect anything?
Well, the only thing the average person can do is to get together with other so-called average people and to take a stand on a particular
issue. Would you say perhaps the first step would be to become fully informed as possible?
Right. And so I would advise them all to read my books first.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about your new book, the one you're writing. Is Public Education Necessary? You just started to get into this. I'd like to know a little more about the theme or the idea behind it.
Well, as I said, the purpose of that book is to open the debate on the viability of public education for our society. You know, every totalitarian society boasts about its public educational system. The Cubans, the Russians, the Nazis, they all had marvelous public school systems because that was the vehicle by which the children could be made into obedient servants of the dictatorship. And it's curious that teachers have always been willing to serve totalitarians. They have never had any problem finding teachers to teach children to betray their parents, to teach children to turn them in, to inform on their parents and that sort of thing. The totalitarian states always have plenty of teachers willing to do the job of the dictator. And I'm afraid that that's the kind of situation we're getting in this country, particularly where teachers are being politicized by the teacher unions to become politically active and to support certain candidates.
I'm aware of this. I saw the recent NEA bulletin in which it was stated that we now, meaning the NEA, we now have the power to put in any president we wish. So I'm sure the it's quite political now.
Yes, they've become a very strong political lobby, and their only interest is in serving their own ends. They're not interested in, quote, education, unquote. First of all, they don't even know what education is. They refuse to define it. You know, nobody in this country can define education.
But let's try to define it. Can you define it for me?
Well, to me, I look at education in two parts. There's self-education and there's formal education. I believe that the purpose of formal education is to serve self-education. In other words, formal education is supposed to provide the student with the necessary skills and tools whereby he can keep educating himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because every human being is a self-educator. We start as educating ourselves as children, because a six-year-old who gets into the first grade comes to school having taught himself to speak his own language.
Mm-hmm.
He has learned to speak perhaps 6,000 words on his
own.
Or
more, I would say.
Or more. Some people say. Some people estimate that children, six-year-olds, have a vocabulary of 10,000 words.
And I've even heard a higher figure.
All right. Now, if a six-year-old can teach himself his own language and learn 10,000 words by trial or error, he is not an uneducated human being. He's not stupid, you
mm-hmm.
see. But the minute he gets into the so-called formal public school system, they try to make themselves, they try to give the child the impression that without them, the child can never learn anything.
Mm-hmm.
That public that education is his means, that is formal education is
mm-hmm.
his means of getting anywhere
well,
in the world.
Well, of course, that brings immediately to mind people like Jessica Mitford, who went to, I don't think she went to school ever a day in her life. She now teaches in, I think she teaches in a university in California. There are many great people. Well, Benjamin Franklin and I think went through two grades, maybe, of formal
right.
education. Shakespeare had no college, and
right.
yet hundreds of college professors are still trying to analyze this brilliant man.
Exactly, exactly. As a matter of fact, formal education has very limited, a limited effect.
Mm-hmm.
It can do so much, but our particular formal educationists have made it the end-all and be-all.
Mm-hmm.
of human self-improvement, as if a human being couldn't possibly educate himself.
I see.
And so they've gone, the reason why they've done this is because they want to make themselves indispensable.
Yes.
When you have a couple of million teachers who are not doing much teaching, but are on the receiving end of a tremendous amount of money
mm-hmm.
that runs into the billions of dollars, they've got to justify what they're doing.
This is true. Well, I'm curious about one question. I've researched a great deal since I began this series, but I haven't gotten yet into the research on mandatory public education in other countries. For example, now I would imagine ours was based upon Horace Mann's findings in Prussia.
Right.
Back in the 1700s, I believe, wasn't it?
1800s.
1800s.
Yes. See, our compulsory educational system is based on the Prussian system.
Uh-huh.
Horace Mann visited Prussia and brought back a glowing report.
Yes.
He wrote a glowing report on his trip, which is known as the 7th Annual Report that he published. And it is more or less the basis of our public educational
mm-hmm.
system. And he was criticized at the time, incidentally, for wanting to adopt the educational system of a dictatorship, of a militaristic country. Monarchy,
yes.
and transplanting it into this country, and he was criticized. He was told that this is not going to make free people. But his answer was, well, if the Prussians can use it to make subservient people, we can use it
to make free people.
But
that's
of course, the founders of our country didn't have public education, and as a matter of fact, our American Revolution took place because there was no public education to brainwash them. In other words, the British didn't have a public educational system getting everyone to agree that the Queen or the King was the absolute monarch and
mm-hmm.
that they had to live their lives according to the way the authorities wanted.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I just mentioned Prussia. How about some of the other countries? Let's say Switzerland, Norway, Sweden, Italy. How about, don't we have, though, I'm being devil's advocate here for a moment, don't we have some form of compulsory, mandatory public education in most countries in the world today?
Well, yes, we have it in most countries
How
today.
Can we avoid it, in other words?
Oh, we can't avoid it. We don't have to have it, but we have it simply because it seems to be the trend, you
mm-hmm.
see, and especially when the United States does something, everybody thinks that it's good. For example, in the United States, we teach children to read by the look-say method,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yes. I have tutored many children
All
in
right.
phonics, and I enjoyed reading your book, The New Illiterates, and How to Keep Your Child from Becoming One. which I would like to urge all of our listeners to rush out and buy if they can find copies, because it's a very fine book on that subject.
All right. Now, we adopted the look-say method in this country, and because we use that method, other countries
have adopted it, simply
because it's American, They figure that anything America does must be good.
Of course, that look-say method was based on the premise that we do not have a phonetic language. Is that correct?
Well, it's not based particularly on that premise. It was based on the idea that you can teach an alphabetic language as if it wasn't an alphabetic language.
As if it were hieroglyphics.
Right, as if it were hieroglyphics. And the man who invented the method was a teacher of the deaf and dumb.
That'd be that school in Boston,
the school in Hartford, Thomas
Hartford.
H. Gallaudet.
Gallaudet School for the Deaf.
Right, he was the first director of the Hartford School for the Deaf and Dumb.
Now, your research led you to this, that he was the originator of whole word or look-say method
in this country. Right.
And then he threw it out, the look-say method in general, it had never been tried.
Oh, before.
I see. And then of course that was thrown out after two or three years in that school, was it not?
Well, about 8 years.
It
was used in Boston. In other words, Gallaudet thought that he could adapt for use by normal children a method which he had used to teach deaf children to read, and he wrote a primer for normal children on that basis. It was adopted by Horace Mann in the Boston school system and used for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of which it was thrown out because it was a total failure.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened was that the method became divorced from its origins and entered the mainstream of American instruction. And in that way, a method used to teach abnormal children to read is now used to teach normal children to read.
That's fascinating. It's grim, but it's fascinating.
Yes, it's sort of frightening to think that the American parent is sending his child to school to be taught to read as if he were deaf.
I may not be correct on this point, but it is my understanding that today we have the highest functional illiteracy rate in the world, that is, of technologically advanced countries. Is this correct?
Well, I don't know. I don't think there have been any figures on, international statistics on functional literacy. Mm-hmm. All I can say is that this country itself has a very severe problem, mm-hmm. reading problem of functional literacy, that is, of people who can't read above the fifth or sixth grades.
Mm-hmm.
And we just don't know the extent of the damage this is doing to our society.
Well, I've seen much of this damage firsthand. For example, several years ago I went to a correctional school for boys, a very fine school near my home in Pennsylvania, and I was talking with the headmaster or the director, and he said that there were many interesting studies of a direct correlation between inability to read and frustration over it with crime, drugs, etc., dropouts.
Yes, right. You do have a great deal of violence because these
total frustration
these youngsters who are frustrated. They live in a society that which demands high literacy, but they come through an educational system which doesn't give them the ability to attain high literacy. So they feel particularly frustrated, and they wonder whether to blame themselves or the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually blame the schools because they sense there is something wrong with the schools.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting about young people is that they're not fooled. When I was substitute teaching in the high schools of Quincy, when I was researching my first book on private schools, one of the complaints of the students was that they weren't learning anything.
Mm-hmm. So students themselves were unhappy that they were not learning or being challenged.
Right. They know they're not learning anything. They know that they're being cheated and deceived because they're getting diplomas for doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So they know there's something wrong. They know the diploma is worthless. I mean, I know high school graduates who can't read above a fourth grade level and who are now in their postgraduate years getting some remedial attention. Now, they know they've been given diplomas, so they know that the school system is phony because they know the diploma stands for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't fool these children.
That's true. Well, of course, to take the other side for a moment to try to balance out this interview, there are some schools, I'm sure, in the country who do use intensive phonics.
Yes, there are.
They're in the minority, I'm afraid, but
yes,
there
the
are
minority.
Some schools. I've talked with some superintendents who
public schools.
Yes, there are a few.
Yeah, there are some public. I would say
they're adopting some
about 25% of the schools in this country.
Oh, that's wonderful. I was afraid it was only about 15%.
No, but I'm saying 15% perhaps of the public schools, but it's the private schools.
Oh, the private schools are using it.
75% of the private schools use phonics,
mm-hmm.
intensive phonics.
Of course, we're not speaking about the so-called progressive schools that some of our national leaders attended when they were quite young, when they did not learn to read. We're not speaking of those progressive private schools.
No, we're talking about the parentally oriented schools, the southern schools that have
mm-hmm.
sprung up like mushrooms all over the South.
Yes, I'm
Christian
familiar with one
schools.
School in Pensacola, I believe, where it started out 20 years ago with about 30 students, and today they have about, I think, 10 or 15,000 students.
Well,
I don't know. Maybe I have my figures mixed up. I get confused on figures. But this school has started, you know, on a very small scale, first and second grade. It added two grades each year, and they now have a college.
Right.
So then they have a kindergarten now. So they're getting marvelous results in this Christian
yes.
school.
Yeah, there are these Christian schools that are sprouting up all over the country. You have various kinds of alternative schools
mm-hmm.
to public education, where the stress usually is on intensive phonics, because they
mm-hmm.
realize that the parents certainly realize that when they're paying for the school directly,
they want
results.
Absolutely.
And they're not going to be satisfied with fun and games.
Yeah.
You know?
I was interested when I was reading your book, How to Start Your Own Private School and Why You Need One. By the way, what year did this come out, this Arlington House publisher?
72, I believe.
72, uh-huh. I've read it several times.
Well, no, that's the second printing, 73.
72 it first came out, uh-huh. It's a fascinating book, and you went into great detail about how these Christian schools around the country have, and other private schools have, given great hope to the
yes.
Future of
right.
of education.
Well, I feel this way, that we're going to have leaders, and our leaders are going to have to be able to read, and so they're going to come out of the schools that have produced the people who can read. They're
mm-hmm.
not going to come out of the schools that are producing dropouts and
mm-hmm.
juvenile delinquents and functional illiterates.
Mm-hmm.
So that the chances are that you're going to get a lot of very fine people
mm-hmm.
out of these private schools.
And yet, just several days ago before I left Pennsylvania, I read a news story about, I didn't read the details, I plan to read it in detail later, but it was about the newest trend to withhold federal lunch money, book money, etc., from the private schools. So the private schools seem to be fighting a very hard uphill battle right now.
Oh yes, the financial battle is a tough one, but parents have to realize that freedom is not free, you know, that you have to pay for it, and it has never been free, and the worst thing that we can pretend is that it is free. And so they have to support their own schools. They've got to pay for it, but they're going to get better results from it. I mean, unfortunately, the parent has to support public education as well as
yes.
the private school. He's taxed in a way double. But
some people have criticized the Reading Reform Foundation for its so-called, quote, elitist, end quote, attitude. And the same thing may be said of private schools. Only the people who are rather affluent can afford these schools. What about the poor average
That's
guy?
That's not so. The southern schools are not supported by the affluent. They're supported by the community,
mm-hmm.
by the average individual. I mean, these are parents who are simply concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And if a parent is really genuinely concerned about his child's safety and his child's education, his child's future, he is going to find the means to give that child a decent education. He's not
mm-hmm.
going to complain about it. I mean, if you buy your child shoes and if you give them food and clothing, etc., and then you find that you also have to pay for education, you'll do it. You'll do
mm-hmm.
it. You change
priorities.
You feel
that the determination then of the parents is the big factor. Whether they can afford it or not, if they're determined enough, they will.
Our only hope are the parents. Our only hope, we must rely on the parents.
Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of parents are put down today who try to affect education, they go to the schools and they're told, well, you're only a parent and you really don't know very much. Leave it to the, quote, experts, end quote.
Well, I'm afraid that the parents are going to have to learn. That's all there is to it. For example, the people in Boston now who are trying to start their own school, their parents, they know absolutely nothing about education. They know absolutely nothing about running a school, but they have to learn. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes necessity makes you do things that you don't ordinarily do.
This is true.
And that's what's happening. When you have to know these things to survive, you get to know them. Mm-hmm. You do what you have to do if survival is the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And the survival of this country as a free country is certainly the issue. And a parent's right to make decisions about their children's future is certainly the issue.
How does one affect legislative measures? How do we really affect this? I talked with a woman last week from Shenango Valley, from where I come, who attended a public hearing on recodification of the Pennsylvania Code of Education, and she was amazed when she went to this public hearing. Very few people were allowed the opportunity to express any views. It was not a very democratic hearing, and she was very upset by it. What do you do, write your senators, your legislators? Do you send them telegrams? Do you call them? What do you do?
That can help to some extent, but you know, I am very much anti-frustration. I'm pro-fulfillment, anti-frustration. And there's nothing more frustrating than trying to get the bureaucracy to change.
Mm-hmm.
To try and
so
get the establishment do things your way. So what
mm-hmm.
you do is that you leave them alone and you create your own school. In other
mm-hmm.
words, it's harder work, but you're not going to be frustrated. In other words, fulfillment is always much more difficult
mm-hmm.
because it requires real effort.
Mm-hmm.
But then at least you know you're not going to be frustrated.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend who is a minister. He's also a teacher in the guidance department of a high school back in Shenango Valley. He told me the other day that he felt so strongly about this that he said if it were on the voting ticket tomorrow, he said I would, even though I would vote myself out of a job, I would vote for the abolition of the public schools. Of course, he would like to see something in its place. He wouldn't like to see a vacuum there, but I think he was serious about this.
Well, I think a lot of people are serious about it. A lot of people in the public educational system are quite disgusted with it. But you know, it's very hard to fight something as big and powerful as an entrenched bureaucracy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And especially when your living depends on it.
Well, you're doing a fine job with your books. I'd like to mention all the names of all of your books. The New Illiterates and How to Keep Your Child from Becoming One. That was Arlington House Publishers, Boston. And I loved
Arlington House, New Rochelle.
Oh, New Rochelle, I'm sorry. And then your book, How to Tutor, that was a fascinating book. I'm proud to say we have a copy of it in our Buell Henderson Library now. And then you have written Retreat from Motherhood. Now, that will be out
in July.
In a few months. Well, by the time we air the show, it probably will be out. That is also Arlington House.
Right. That's
New Rochelle.
Arlington,
uh-huh.
Right. New Rochelle, New York.
And then the book you're currently working on is Public Education Necessary? And I hope that some of our listeners will be interested enough to write or order from their local bookstore some of your books or all of your books. And before we close our interview here, is there any particular point we haven't covered? I know we've left uncovered many, many good points, but can you think of one specific point you might like to end with?
Well, the one point I'd like to end with is that the future of this country really is in the hands of the parents of this country, because your educational system is going to determine whether you're going to have a free country or not. And it's only the parents of this country can take their children out of the public school system and set up their own schools, or at least, you know, finance them and
mm-hmm.
hire the people they want
mm-hmm.
to run these schools so that they at least they represent the parents' values.
Mm-hmm.
And so I must emphasize that it must come from the parents, because the parents have that sense of responsibility,
mm-hmm.
the love of their children,
mm-hmm.
and they have the families which create the fabric of our society.
Yes.
You see, so it's up to them. The single people are not going to do it. the swingers are not going to do it. No matter how much liberty they want, they're not going to they're not going to preserve this country. It's the parents who are going to have to do it.
Yes.
I'm afraid they have to take on this additional burden on themselves, but let's face it, it was done in 1776, and it'll have to be done in 1976.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Blumenfeld, for your interview, and hopefully we can talk again on another subject and about perhaps some other books you'll be writing in the future.
Yes, thank you very much.